Gata and opening the sutra.
The way I would like for you to announce your cons when you come into me in the future. You know, gateless gate, case 31, whatever. Just thought I'd squeeze that little info in there. Peter mentioned the other night that the structure of Dharma talks is like jazz with lyrical variations spun out of a set melody, or in the case of Dharma talks, cons. I love that description because it redefines ADD in a good way, and it helps justify why this talk will wander around, questioning questions, inquiring into suffering, and returning, I hope, to the koan. A monk asked an old woman, "What is the way to Taizan?" The old woman said, "Go straight on." After the monk had done a few steps, she said, "This good, honest priest goes off that way, too." Later, a monk told Joshua about this. Joshua said, "Wait a bit. I will go and see through the old woman for you." The next day, he went and asked her the same question, and the old woman also made the same reply. On returning, Joshua said to his disciples, "I have seen through the old woman of Taizan." Most of us are familiar with Joshu or Chaozhu, or Xiaozhu, who appears in the first koan book, Moonman Khan. And case 31 is the sixth time he shows up. I noticed that he's also in the Hidden Lamp, which is the koans that feature women six times, although this koan is not in the Hidden Lamp. Joshu is known for his unerring eye, his spontaneity, his ability to take whatever was at hand and turn it to the purpose of teaching. So what is Taizan in the question? What is the way to Taizan? It is a mountain in northern China known as the dwelling place of Manjushri, who's back there on the wall, who has the sword of truth to cut to the essence. He sees the phenomena. So the old woman has a tea house at the base of the mountain, and she meets many monks looking to ascend the mountain. They may be looking for a teacher. There were and still are many monasteries and lamaseries up there. When Sukhita wrote his commentaries, there was upwards of 20. So it's been this special mountain for a long time. There's so much that this koan leaves out. We don't know whether the path or road that she's on leads straight up the mountain. As far as we know, she doesn't say which way is straight, east or west. At any rate, the actual mountain has five peaks, so we don't know when she says straight on if she's giving a straight answer. Assume she is for a moment, and she's just an ordinary soul who gives good directions. But would an ordinary soul likely say, once the seeker has started, "This good, honest priest goes off that way too"? Well, given that translation, she might be approving of the monk's determination. But a different translation from Yamada Roshi has her comment this way. He may look like a fine monk, but he goes off that way too. This "but" indicates she's judging him, perhaps for plotting obedience. Or maybe she's got Zen and is saying, as many masters have, only go straight and don't look for your truth from others. Proceed doggedly, not getting distracted. Sing Song, the great late contemporary Korean Zen master, who I mentioned in my last Dharma talk, had a single way of ending every letter that he wrote, and also ended every retreat with this. Only go straight, don't know, try for 10,000 years. Soon, get enlightenment and save all beings from suffering. 10,000 years is sick. This koan arises out of a question. In fact, there's two more questions in the koan, and it got me thinking about questions. The monks ask, what's the deal with the old lady? Where does she get off mocking us? Or maybe they wonder if she's an adept, like Joshi was mocking them for going off to find somebody. They find something they already have within them, following the beaten path. And we might wonder whether there's some Zen significance to her saying, straight ahead, which, as I mentioned, is traditional advice to students. Don't know, just go. Keep going without reaching out for reasons or justifications. This not knowing is the topic of Jamie's talk last night. The importance of plowing ahead without knowing outcomes is not unique to Zen. It's actually where we are all the time, even though we think we know. In existentialism, for example, there is the famous existential leap. We can't know the essence of anything until we have first leapt and gone through the existence of it. In Zen metaphors, have stepped off the 100-foot pole, let go of the branch between our teeth, jumped off the cliff. This process is as true for writing as it is for anything else. Anne Forster asks rhetorically, how can I know what I mean until I see what I say? In any case we choose, we're chronically in the same place as Ryotan left Tokusan in the dark, where knowing just doesn't cut it. If we look closely, not knowing pervades everywhere. Take, for example, the first of the four vows, which is sometimes translated as Dharma gates are countless, I vow to wake to them. We say creations. Embedded in there is the idea that we are not awake. Before we wake to them, they are paths of confusion. Or it could mean that we're going along practicing a self-aware not knowing until not knowing itself begets an insight. Sometimes in that process, being present, we come to formulate a question. Questions generate koans, as I said. One way of looking at many koans is that unenlightened monks or students ask questions that they can't have answered for them by the Zen master. They have to answer them for themselves. So the old saying, opening one's mouth, already the first mistake, really holds true for many koans. But what that view of questions, being mistakes, misses is that when we ask a big question, we are, in a sense, just where we need to be, in the dark, not simply in ignorance, but open and not knowing. Often the teacher will only increase that dark, but thank Buddha for questions. In Robert Aitken's wonderful book of contemporary koans, I think I may have mentioned this the other night, Zen Master Raven, that's the name of the book, a group of animals discuss Dharma. Aitken's koan, Spirit of the Practice, goes like this. Relaxing with the others after Zazen one evening, Owl asked, what is the spirit of the practice? Raven said, inquiring. Al cocked his head and asked, what do I inquire about? Raven said, good start. So back to Arcona. Joshu gets a report about this old woman, the tea lady, and says he'll go down and decide what's what with her. He does, he asks her the same question the other monks asked, and she gives Joshu the same reply she gave the monks. So Joshu comes back and says to the monk, I've seen through this old woman, what ties on for you? What in heck does this mean? What did he see? The monks asked a question of Joshu, and his answer leaves, or should leave them, in the dark. When we say in contemporary parlance, we saw right through him, we mean we unmasked someone's pretense. But is that what Joshu means? Or did he see right through her to her enlightened nature? Or something in between? This is known as a tough koan. No less of a Zen master than Hakuin was totally baffled about it for a very long time. And in the one Teisha I read, they quote a non-authoritative commenter as saying that both Joshu and the old woman are equally enlightened, so this ends in a tie. It's a nice opinion, but we need to ask, how does that commentator know this? Does he know this simply because he can't stand not knowing? Which is what we do so often in human events. As T.S. Eliot said, or says in our service book, human beings can't stand very much reality. I think if we were open, we are left suspended by Joshu's comment. We'd like to know what Joshu really means. We want to know the last word. But before any imagined last word, we have to cope with his last two words. Joshu says, I have seen through her for you. Can anyone see through another person for you? It's no secret that koans beget a special form of suffering. We might label it, if we want to have a label on it, as productive or perhaps liberating suffering. But it's suffering nonetheless. And suffering, let's just look at suffering in a larger context. In Buddhism, the first noble truth is that suffering pervades existence. There's some contemporary debate about this translation. The word for suffering, dukkha, means out of balance, as in an unbalanced wagon wheel. And so we can tell ourselves that we are not always out of kilter. We have some suffering some of the time. In a recent movie, which I recommend on Netflix, the name of which escapes me, it's about Tibetan Buddhists. You can sort of tell by the logo. It's about Tibetan Buddhists and what's happened to their religion after being thrown out of Tibet. And the thesis of the movie has become a world religion. And as we know, Tibetan Buddhists put a huge emphasis on happiness. But paradoxically, they insist very strongly that suffering is utterly pervasive. And as one nun said in that movie, it also can be incredibly subtle. So this set me thinking about what happens to us when we get up in the morning. If you're really present to yourself, your ordinary self, you'll notice that there's a hint in unease as in everything, as in having an unmet need. These desires can be or seem benign. We get up in the morning, and even if we feel good and happy, we still want our tea or our coffee. If we don't get that, we're out of kilter. The same is true for food or exercise. I wake up and think, boy, it's time to walk that dog Benny, who I so love and so wanted, but it's 10 below. Suffering. Or maybe we wake up as my students do and feel compelled to tune into their cell phones to find out if they still exist, as evidenced by the fact that someone texted them while they slept. Or maybe we don't feel right until we find out what the weather is. It's a daily drama. We have to read the headlines. If we don't read the headlines, we won't know where we are. We won't know what shit is coming down. Or we eat breakfast, as I do, and often enough, I've eaten more than I need, even if it's less than I wanted. Suffering. Or maybe during breakfast, we were listening to NPR, or reading the sports pages, or People magazine, or Tricycle, and we haven't tasted a bite. Suffering. Despite ourselves, we want. We get done with acquiring breakfast, and then it's on to the next thing. We look at our car, or our shirt, or our brand of cigarettes, as Mick Jagger did so long ago, and find you can't get no satisfaction. Mick Jagger was mad at the ads telling him that his shirt wasn't white enough. But those ads couldn't make him feel bad if he didn't have a built-in dukkha head. Greed, anger, and ignorance. Existence entails craving that brings suffering. What can we do? We can be aware. We can inquire into it. And indeed, not all of what we desire makes us sick. Poetry, for me, for example, is a good example. And I agree with EQ, who says that poetry is hellish bullshit, but one good way to suffer. Bodhisattvas suffer because not all beings are liberated. Another good way to suffer is to inquire, as opposed to acquire, into the big questions that Jamie mentioned. What's my essential nature? What am I doing here? Is there meaning in this life? What's worth doing? What is the great matter of life and death? Questions like these are a good place to start, and we need to keep asking them, even if they beget other questions and no answers. I just was reading in this book today. It's a brand new book by Jane Hirschfield. And here's what she says. There are questions that never run out of questions. Answers that don't exhaust answer. So we may be going along not knowing, and it may seem paradoxical to ask a question to end that not knowing, even though we know not knowing is where we should be. But it happens again and again in Zen. Master Zuigan woke up every morning and asked himself a question. Master, are you there? I am. Then he asked some version, are you awake or are you sober? Even an enlightened master asks himself if he's really there. And then he reminds himself not to listen to someone else's bullshit about who he is. Even Zuigan couldn't stop practicing. It's possible someday that the dream of reality may be transformed into the dream of enlightenment. Then you really have a bowlful in front of you. So let me respectfully remind you that we are near the last word of the session. It's going to end soon, and our challenge is not to be invaded by the future, by the I've got us. If we do, we will lose what Thoreau called, and what I read you today at lunch, the bloom of the present moment. The future will arrive, whether we meddle with it or angst about it. No question about it. The session will be over, and another little death, another return to the American dream machine. But we're still here. We've bracketed this time, some people at great expense. Every moment, we have a chance to face this moment, to go straight, or as Joshu says, to see through. How deep into seeing can we go? If you let the proximity of the end divert you, you are practicing distraction. Every moment is a Dharma gate. How many of them can we still meet? A monk once asked asked an old woman, what's the way to Taizan? The old woman said, go straight on. after the monk had done a few steps, she said, "This good, honest monk priest, this good, honest priest goes off that way too." Later, a monk told Joshu about this. Joshu said, "Wait a bit. I'll go and see through the old woman for you." The next day, he went, asked the same question, and the old woman also made the same reply. On returning, Joshu said to my disciples, "I have seen through the old woman of Taizan."
Creations are numberless, I vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible, I vow to put an end to them. Reality is boundless, I vow to perceive it. The enlightened way is unsurpassable, I vow to embody it. Creations are numberless, I vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible, I vow to put an end to them. Reality is boundless, I vow to perceive it. The enlightened way is unsurpassable, I vow to embody it. Creations are numberless, I vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible, I vow to put an end to them. Reality is boundless, I vow to perceive it. The enlightened way is unsurpassable, I vow to embody it.